transition to democracy. But I think John Kerry is the only person in the world who sees that transition.
Ken Roth, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. And Sharif, thanks for joining us from Cairo, Sharif Abdelkadous, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Egypt. That does it for the broadcast. Very happy birthday to Hani Massoud. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. DemocracyNow.org is our website.
Let KBOO send you to beautiful Mexico and stay at Casa Tranquila. Or go see a play at Pullman Center Stage with your friends. KBOO's Fall Sweepstakes is currently happening, and these are two of the fabulous prizes that we have in store. For every $15,000 we raise between now and September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. Other prizes include $500 to Grand Central Bakery and three different prize packs from Evolution Healthcare and Fitness, including altitude training, massage, and acupuncture. Thank you to all the local businesses that have donated prizes for the KBOO Fall Sweepstakes. A donation is not required to be entered. For rules and more info, KBOO.fm/2015FallSweeps.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years and creates a space for understanding the impacts of police violence and imagining a world without police. Again, that's Arresting Power, Thursday, September 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Obama pledges to address climate change while protesters from Alaska to Portland challenge his decision to allow Arctic drilling.
Workers at a Tennessee nuclear power plant go on strike.
And the proposed oil terminal on the Columbia River in Vancouver, Washington, moves forward another step as a judge rules against the activists trying to stop it. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 31st, 2015. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
And I'm Emily Young. Coalitions opposed to an energy terminal on the Columbia River received a blow last week when Washington's Court of Appeals upheld an earlier decision saying the terminal meets state regulations. The terminal, which will be located near downtown Vancouver, will be the largest in the Pacific Northwest. Hundreds of local residents have turned up at every public meeting on the topic, voicing concerns about the environment and safety. The terminal will be used to transfer crude oil from trains to ocean-going vessels. The Columbia Riverkeeper and the Northwest Environmental Defense Center sought a ruling against the terminal, saying that it did not comply with the State Environmental Policy Act. A number of groups opposed the terminal, including the Vancouver City Council, small business owners in the city, and local tribes. However, the project has received support from a number of big businesses, including Portland-area companies that will benefit from the influx of crude oil. Vancouver area groups also oppose the terminal because it poses a safety issue to the surrounding city. A planned waterfront development of housing and shops will not move ahead if the oil terminal is built. The terminal will be five times larger than any other oil by train project in the Northwest.
President Obama has renamed Mount McKinley, North America's highest mountain, back to its indigenous name of Denali. Mount Denali was originally named renamed Mount McKinley by President Wilson in 1917 after President McKinley, who was the president of the U.S. at the turn of the century until he was assassinated in 1901 by a young anarchist who thought McKinley represented the interests of the rich at the expense of the poor. This past weekend, President Obama used the mountain as a backdrop, calling for strong actions to fight climate change. The president said that the fight against climate change will be a top priority for the final year of his administration. The president's statement follows his decision 2 weeks ago to grant final approval to Shell Oil to begin drilling in the Arctic, despite that company's history of spills and other problems.
As President Obama was in Alaska today for a meeting with world leaders about climate change in the Arctic, he was met by hundreds of protesters challenging his decision to allow Shell Oil to drill in the Arctic, a move they say will greatly increase climate change and is likely to result in difficult-to-access oil spills. In Portland, a rally in March was held midday today in solidarity with the Alaskan activists. The group Shell Know organized the event, which included a funeral procession and a die-in for the Arctic at the federal building in downtown Portland. According to the protest organizers, Arctic drilling, which will wreak havoc on the fragile ecosystems of the Arctic and bring us ever closer to surpassing the 2-degree threshold that scientists have warned will cause irreversible climate catastrophe and massive loss of life. Here are some excerpts from the rally recorded by KBOO's Paul Rowland.
I'm here because the United States military considers climate change to be the greatest national security threat that we've ever seen. And it's a great intervention point when we're talking to climate deniers to ask them if they disagree with the Defense Department of the United States.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the Arctic, what we're talking about is the greatest potential conflict zone of the 21st century. There are 7 nations that claim the Arctic, and 2 of those nations are currently fighting a proxy war in the Ukraine. That's the United States and Russia. We should be seriously concerned about the melting Arctic and the future for conflict between our nations, because this is one of those things that can easily stumble into a nuclear war scenario. We are talking not only about the indigenous peoples that live there, but we're talking about life on this planet. And whatever framework you want to take a look at this, whether it's national security or whether it's our scientists telling us that it is not an option to drill in the Arctic if we want to keep ourselves under 2 degrees Celsius, considered to be the only possible safe future for this planet. So this is not just a local issue, this is a global issue. And for those people who call themselves American patriots, I challenge them to stand up and take a look at the real threats to their own future. And one of those is in our backyard, and that is drilling in the Arctic. So that's why I'm here today. And we are demanding that President Obama actually stand up to his pledge to address climate change and rescind permission for Shell to drill in the Arctic.
Right. Yeah. Woo-hoo-hoo! Thank you.
I had never been in a kayak before Portland Shell Know. And it was an incredible experience. I really understood what solidarity meant when I was under that bridge and calling up to the Greenpeace activists, when I was calling back to the people on the shore, when I was texting my friends around the country and around the world that this was happening. I'm so inspired by the people who have stood up against climate destruction. Shell is tapping the veins of the earth for profit. Our president has written his legacy in oil, lit the match that will destroy our planet unless we stop this. Indigenous mothers, fathers, and children will die if we allow this lust for profit to desecrate their lands. Oceans will teem with the corpses of our greed. If we don't resist, we condone murder. President Obama, their blood is on your hands. The earth is on fire. My beautiful green state has seen drought. Nestle is bottling up our rivers. There is no quenching their thirst. Our children will we can't grow food in the cracked, fracked soil, the never-ending pillaging for oil is a genocide. But we are a rising tide, and we will flood the system.
I believe that, you know, veterans, we took an oath to defend against all threats, foreign and domestic, and this is one of the greatest domestic threats we have right now. Like I said, even if you don't believe in any of the climate science, even if you can't get behind that kind of message, there's still a 75% chance that this rig is going to leak, that it's going to completely destroy the coastline from here to Alaska and beyond. Obama is saying, like, oh, if we have domestic oil, it's going to be so much better than going for foreign. But once again, this is just an attack on things that should not be attacked, just like the oil every day.
My name is Carrie. I'm from Portland. I've lived here my entire life. This Arctic oil drilling doesn't just affect the Arctic, it affects the whole world, as you know, and that affects all indigenous peoples and all non-indigenous peoples, so we need to do something about this, and we need to do it now. Yeah. The I Don't Know More movement was started a few years ago in Canada because of Harper allowing all of the drilling and the oil production, and this is just an extension of that. It's just moving over farther, and it's causing more damage to this planet. We need to do something about it. And like I said, we need to do something about it now.
As you can see from the crowd, there's a lot of people here that are very concerned that Obama is acting like a hypocrite when he claims he wants to act on climate change. And he's,
what do you think?
Well, of course, I think he is being hypocritical. He's opening up one of the largest unproven reserves in the Arctic, giving Shell the green light to go ahead and drill when we know that we need to keep 80% of all proven fossil fuel reserves in the ground. So, you know, it's like it's his evil twin. We can't quite figure out why he takes action on climate change with the Clean Power Plan, for example, and then gives the green light to Shell. We heard after the Fenica blockade that a bunch of us participated in at the end of July, where we kept that icebreaker in Portland for several days, we heard that folks in the Shell headquarters were actually privately saying they had reservations about drilling in the Arctic, and they felt that it was a crazy thing to be doing. So, you know, at this point, we're told there are two factors that will affect whether or not they drill in the Arctic. One is the price of oil, and if it stays low, it will mean they'll be less interested in continuing to drill. The other is their public relations, and if we can give them a black eye by associating Arctic drilling with ecocide, and that's what we're doing here today, maybe Shell will finally pull out. But, you know, I think eventually we will prevail.
Shell no!
Portland says!
Shell no!
Portland says!
Shell no!
Portland says!
Shell no!
Portland.
Those were the sounds of a rally earlier today in opposition to Arctic drilling. The voices you heard included Graham Klumpner with Iraq Veterans Against the War, Kerry with Idle No More, and local climate activist Daphne Weishin. The organizers of today's action, the Shell No Action Council, has made four demands of the Obama administration. The group demands a rapid transition to renewable energy, the end of exploratory drilling in the Arctic, the protection of Indigenous peoples' rights and communities, and binding agreements at the 2015 UN Climate Change Conference that are on par with what science has shown is necessary for a livable future.
Despite strong thunder and a lightning storm this weekend, along with the rain that hit the Portland area, the wildfires throughout Oregon and Washington continue to burn. The cooler weather has allowed fire crews to make progress on the wildfires that have darkened western skies over the last several weeks. The Canyon Creek fire is now considered 50% contained. Meanwhile, the nation's largest wildfire, the Okanagan wildfire in Washington, is now considered to be 25% contained. It's burned more than 500 square miles, making it the largest wildfire in Washington state history. The U.S. Forest Service reported that it's currently spending $10 million per day to fight the wildfires in Oregon and $150 million per week nationwide on wildfire containment.
Governor Kate Brown has endorsed an offshore wind project that could secure nearly $47 million in federal grants. A demonstration for the project will take place off the coast of Coos Bay with the help of the California-based wind company Principal. Principal is one of three companies that will receive funds from the Department of Energy to explore the viability of energy source. The initial wind float Pacific project demonstration will generate 30 megawatts of power, enough to power 7,000 homes. Governor Brown hopes the project will support hundreds of new jobs for Oregonians.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Zoe Blunt, who is part of an indigenous encampment on unceded land in British Columbia. The encampment is blocking construction of a tar sands pipeline from Alberta to the Pacific Ocean. The protesters are facing an imminent raid from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. This will be followed by Labour Radio at 6. Tonight's show features guests from the Pacific Northwest Labour History Association talking about labour history here in Oregon. At 6:30 on Prison Pipeline, Karen James speaks with Gretchen Valla of Oregon Cure to discuss the Obama administration's recent announcement to pay for the college education of state and federal prisoners. On Prison Pipeline, and at 7, it's the River Signal, KBOO's collaborative effort with a group of music enthusiasts who've spent the summer traveling down the Mississippi River in an old tugboat, providing weekly reports each Monday on KBOO from 7 to 8 p.m. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is cloudy with a 20% chance of rain, high of 74 and a low of 55. Today in history, in 2005, the city of New Orleans established a curfew in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. 2 days after the storm made landfall, the U.S. Coast Guard was still finding survivors in the devastation. A public health emergency was declared on August 31st, 2005, due to the lack of clean drinking water. The quote of the day is from Ian McNulty's A Season of Night, New Orleans, Life After Katrina. People don't live in New Orleans because it is easy. They live there because they're incapable of living anywhere else in just the same way.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
History, as the old adage goes, is written by the winners, even though many winners are losers as human beings. For a clear example of this irony, check out the new National Monument to Corporate Greed created by our Park Service in Chicago. It's on the site of what had been Pullman, a company town created by the feudalistic 19th century profiteer George Pullman. He amassed a fortune as a railcar manufacturer, infamously suppressing the wages of his 5,000 factory workers. Yet, he considered himself a beneficent employer, having built a 600-acre town for the workforce and vaingloriously naming the new home place for himself. It included houses he rented to them, churches, schools, a bank, library, and parks, all owned by his company. Indeed, when officials announced this year that Pullman's town was becoming an honored part of America's park system, officials attested to his generosity by hailing it as a place he created, quote, to provide his employees a good life. Pullman Town's workers, however, were less charmed, for he ruled the burg as autocratically as he did his factories. No saloons or agitators allowed, nor did he allow any public speeches, town meetings, independent newspapers, or even open discussions. Resentful residents created a little ditty that summed up the surreal feel of the place. We are born in a Pullman house, fed from the Pullman shops, taught in the Pullman schools, catechized in the Pullman church, and when we die, we shall go to Pullman hell. In 1894, the workers got Pullman's hell on earth when he drastically cut their wages but refused to lower their rent. He had guaranteed a 6% return to the wealthy investors who financed the town, he explained, and their needs came first. This is Jim Hightower saying, now, 120 years later, we taxpayers are financing a monument to this loser's greed?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Over the past weekend, the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast marked the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and the flooding and military state that followed. For more, we go to an interview by Jared Ball with Rosa Clemente and Ajamu Baraka on sister station WPFW, reflecting on this anniversary.
When I got down there, National Guard was still there. The floodwaters were high. Bodies were floating. We made our way through a lot of stops, a lot of M-16s being pointed at us. Before we hit New Orleans, though, we had driven through Mississippi and other areas that have been affected, you know. And I think for me, very politically at that moment and coming home from what I saw down there after being there for almost 6 or 7 days was, I knew then, and I didn't say it, right, like who would have thought Black lives really didn't matter, poor lives didn't matter, and that for me at that moment was also my definitive split with the Democratic Party or politicians. So to hear Chokwe at the beginning and how he broke that down and to say it's the position that we're in also as well as the condition is something that I tried to bring forth in my reporting, like telling the actual truth of what I was seeing, what I was witnessing, and the other devastation of people who literally do not have means that are left to suffer. And then when they do what they have to do to survive, then they're disparaged and marginalized even more. So those are some of my initial thinking.
Ajamu, let me bring you into the conversation. You know, you've been not only, again, as I said at the top, a longtime activist and someone deeply involved in these kinds of struggles for a long time, but you were part of putting together a report in response Hurricane Katrina and the guiding principles on internal displacement, among other things relative to this situation. Please share with us some of your reflections or memories of that time 10 years ago.
Well, my pleasure, and I really thank you for allowing me to be part of the conversation. And I always have a good time when I have a chance to spend some time with Sister Rosa Clemente, who is one of our most outstanding, still relatively young leaders coming up in this country today. We luckily, I mean, as a Southern organizer, you know, I had a particular kind of response to what happened in throughout the Gulf Coast. Organizing in the South since the late 1970s. Luckily, though, I was in a position in 2005. We were building a new human rights network whose primary responsibility was to try to highlight the ongoing human rights crisis in the United States and to hold the U.S. accountable. So we were in a position to, in fact, try to do that in the aftermath of this human-made tragedy. You know, and it's important to point that out, that when we talk about Katrina, we're not talking about the hurricane necessarily. We're talking about the fact that this was a disaster that was a reflection of the irresponsibility, the neglect on the part of public officials. They created levees that were unable to withstand an indirect hit from a hurricane. Do people think that this was a direct hit on New Orleans, and it wasn't. It was an indirect hit on New Orleans, and people knew that those levees were not going to hold. That's a human response. You know, the fact that they used the tragedy to reconstruct not only New Orleans but various parts of the Gulf Coast. All of this was part of human decisions informed by a desire to transform the region to impose a neoliberal transformation on the area. So, you know, as we talk, we want to put this in proper political context. Of course, you know, the human suffering was outrageous. The fact that you had people in places like New Orleans who, for example, the prisoners in the Orleans Parish jail who were left to basically, in some cases, die once they were abandoned by the prison guards. The situation with people who were on the rooftops of their homes and watched the helicopters fly by as Brother Chukwe Lumumba talked about. They went to the other parts of the parish to pick up white folks. These are all reflective of the ongoing human rights crisis that people in New Orleans and across the region and then across this country, African people continue to experience here in this country. So Katrina just sort of highlighted that ongoing criminal experience that we face here in this country.
That was Ajamu Baraka, before him Rosa Clemente, reflecting on the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Ethiopia is about to dam the River Omo and build massive irrigation projects. This has sparked outrage from people living to the south of the proposed dam who are dependent on a lake that is fed by the River Omo. It's believed that the high dam and massive irrigation plans will disastrously impact Kenya's Lake Turkana, Africa's fourth largest lake, upon which 170,000 Kenyans depend for their sustenance. Once the dam is in place, by the end of this year, it's expected the lake's water levels could drop by half, destroying the lake's fisheries. Many of the people of the lower Omo River are direct descendants of the nearby Rift Valley's Lucy, the oldest human remains ever found. The Rift Valley is believed to be the birthplace of the human race. An Oxford University study has pointed out that Ethiopia has never filed construction impact assessments or performed feasibility studies. It has not presented any resettlement plans for the people displaced by the project, nor has it submitted plans for sharing benefits that may accrue from the project. None of the people affected have been given the opportunity to participate in any public process about the dam construction project. Contributing some $800 million to the construction project have been the World Bank, the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, and the U.S. Agency for International Development.
The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute has released new information showing increased radiation levels in the waters off the coast of California. Samples taken 15 miles north of San Diego were found to contain 8.4 becquerels of cesium per meter of water. The samples found levels of cesium-137 and 134 to be three times higher than were present before the Fukushima nuclear accident. Cesium-134 has a half-life of 2 years, and cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years. Both cesium isotopes are produced through the radioactive decay of other isotopes. The samples were not tested for these other radioactive isotopes, which include plutonium, americium, strontium, and radioactive iodine. It's believed that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute is the only organization that's testing for increased radioactivity in the waters of the Pacific Ocean off the west coast of the U.S. The EPA has stated that they are not actively testing for Fukushima radiation that could be arriving on the west coast.
Union workers at the Pantex Nuclear Weapons Plant, a sister plant to Y-12 in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, are on strike. The strike began after the workers rejected a final contract offer and voted to go on strike on Friday night. The strike by more than 1,100 workers at the National Security Site received the support of the Metal Trades Department of the AFL-CIO in Washington. This marks the first strike by the main workforce at Pantex since 1970. Management says they will keep the plant going while the workers are on strike, but it's unclear how the radioactive nuclear components will be kept safe without the highly trained regular workforce there to maintain them.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Roughly 1,200 metal trades workers voted to strike over the weekend at Pantex, a nuclear weapons facility in Amarillo, Texas, with a sister plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. 10 unions comprise the Metal Trades Council at Pantex. The workers voted to start the strike at midnight Saturday. Workers have been in negotiations with Consolidated Nuclear Security since January of 2015. Metal Trades Council President Clarence Rashada says the issue isn't wages, but benefits like sick leave, medical coverage, and prescription drugs. CNS wants to eliminate defined benefit pensions for new hires and shift more health costs onto workers. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Republican presidential candidates are spewing racism and hatred on the immigration issue.
These are hateful and racist viewpoints. They're not accidents. They're intended to demean and divide. There are no codes or hidden messages here. These candidates are telling us they believe that some people are superior and others are inferior, and they intend to govern our country on that basis.
Now here's Mitch Lawrence with Wynn's Sports Minute.
Sad to report, but Planet Lovetron has lost its most famous resident. Daryl Dawkins might have been the only resident of the planet. Dawkins, you see, made it all up. For those who don't remember, Daryl Dawkins was a pro basketball center back in the 1970s and 80s with the Philadelphia 76ers, New Jersey Nets, and a few other teams. This gentle giant of a man was always the life of the party and is best remembered for a few things. First, he was the very first high school player to be drafted by an NBA career and bypassed a college career. Later on, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, and LeBron James all took the same path to the NBA as Dawkins. Now, lots of today's players consider themselves entertainers, but Daryl was probably one of the first. He gave his thunderous dunks nicknames, especially the ones that shattered glass backboards. He also gave himself nicknames. Chocolate Thunder was his best known. And as he often boasted, he came from Planet Lovetron. Actually, he hailed from Orlando, Florida, where the Sixers discovered him before he started his senior season at Maynard Evans High School. They were unimpressed with college players and heard through the grapevine about this kid in Orlando who was bigger, stronger, and better than anyone else. So they drafted him. Although he never made an all-star team, he was all-world when it came to his flamboyant personality. So rest in peace, Chocolate Thunder, and all hail, Planet Lovetron. The Sports Minute for Workers Independent News, this is Mitch Lawrence.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Joined by the American Civil Liberties Union, Planned Parenthood filed a complaint in federal court Friday asking the state of Alabama to stop defunding its health clinics. The organization took similar legal action earlier last week in Louisiana. Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas have targeted Planned Parenthood's Medicaid funding covering preventive health care services like birth control and cancer screenings for low-income women. Conservative reaction to the release of covertly recorded videos purporting to show Planned Parenthood mishandling aborted fetal tissue has set off a chain reaction of legislative actions. However, these are only the most recent moves in what pro-choice advocates claim is a massive attack on women's right to manage their own bodies. Molly Redden, in the current issue of Mother Jones, says that after years of intense pressure on state legislatures to pass anti-abortion measures, Right to Life backers are close to completely blocking lower-income women from obtaining abortions in the United States. Most abortions today, says Redden, require that a patient endlessly await services, traveling long distances to one of the few clinics remaining in operation, and spend a great deal of money. She cites Texas as a leading example of how bad things have gotten. Of the 41 Texas clinics opened in 2012, 23 have been forced to close. The number remaining open will be further reduced to 10 if the Supreme Court allows a Texas state law to stand. The measure, in effect, forces clinics to become small hospitals, something beyond their financial capabilities. The situation has become so bad, says Redden, it's as if the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973 had never happened.
The Supreme Court will face the first religious objection to gay marriage this week from a county clerk in Kentucky. After the Supreme Court's decision in June to allow same-sex marriage across the country, the Kentucky governor ordered county clerks to comply with the decision. But County Clerk Kim Davis has refused to issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. Davis's lawyers state, "This person holds an undisputed, sincerely held religious belief that marriage is a union between a man and woman only." The county clerk is asking for relief from issuing the licenses because of their religious beliefs. Last week, the Sixth Court of Appeals sided with gay and lesbian couples who sued the clerk's office. The appeals court ruling said that it cannot be defensibly argued that the holder of the Rowan County Clerk's office, apart from who personally occupies that office, may decline to act in conformity with the U.S. Constitution. The appeal will be directed to Justice Elena Kagan, and she can either act on it herself or refer it to the full court.
The Egyptian government has sentenced three Al Jazeera reporters to jail for their reporting on the Muslim Brotherhood in the aftermath of the Egyptian Revolution. Egyptian government officials claimed that the reporters were working for the Muslim Brotherhood, spreading false news. Following Egypt's revolution in 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood won a majority of seats in parliamentary elections and began ruling the country. In 2013, Egypt ousted the Muslim Brotherhood in a military coup, promptly labeling the organization as terrorist, jailing hundreds. Free speech organizations around the world have condemned Egypt's recent action, the jailing of respected international reporters. Last year, the United States government gave the Egyptian government more than $1.5 billion in military aid.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imenc.org for Monday, August 31st, 2015. Israeli soldiers attack farmers in Gaza and kidnap civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers stationed across the border fence opened fire on Monday morning at a number of Palestinian farmers in their lands and at several homes east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. According to local media, farmers had to leave their lands and try to seek shelter in their homes that also came under Israeli army fire. The soldiers frequently attack Palestinian homes and lands in border areas in the Gaza Strip, in addition to ongoing assaults and violations targeting Gaza fishers and their boats. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Monday at dawn five Palestinian civilians during invasions targeting a number of West Bank communities. Soldiers kidnapped three young men in Aida refugee camp north of the West Bank city of Bethlehem and one Palestinian in the old city of occupied East Jerusalem, in addition to one in Tul Karim, local sources reported. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday morning the village of Ramona and Zabuba, west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin, stormed homes and searched them, and handed five Palestinians military warrants for interrogation in the Salem military base near Jenin. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers invaded Jabaa town, northwest of occupied East Jerusalem, and demolished 15 sheds and structures belonging to Bedouin families from Al-Arara family. Most of the demolished structures were installed in 1975 and 1976, residents told local media. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, August 31st, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
The president of the Greek Supreme Court was sworn in as interim prime minister late last week following the resignation of Alex Tsipras, who resigned rather than face a no-confidence vote in the Greek legislature. Emestanu Christodoulou will be responsible for supervising the upcoming national election scheduled for September 20th. Prior to becoming interim prime minister, she also held the position of president at the Electoral Court and oversaw the anti-austerity July referendum, as well as the last several elections. New polls showing the anti-austerity Syriza party, led by former Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, leading the pack with a two-point lead over the center-right pro-austerity New Democracy Party. In related Greek news, over 2,500 refugees fleeing war and poverty in the Middle East and North Africa were picked up over the last 3 days by the Greek Coast Guard. Most of the refugees are from Afghanistan and Syria and traveled to Turkey before boarding rafts and small boats for a short trip across the Mediterranean Sea to the Greek coastline. From Greece, the refugees traveled to Serbia and Hungary before entering Western Europe. Almost 200,000 refugees have made the trip from Turkey to Greece since June 1st. There are still over 2 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, many of whom will attempt the trip to Europe in the coming months.
In Austria, authorities have tightened the border to immigrants after the deaths of 71 people last week inside a loaded truck on an Austrian highway. Although the incident is still under investigation, authorities believe the victims were Syrian refugees. The grisly discovery brought worldwide attention to the ongoing crisis and the startling number of migrants who risk their lives to reach the European Union. As reported by Reuters, an estimated 340,000 refugees entered the EU between January and August of this year. An estimated 50% of the refugees are from Eritrea and Syria. Since the year 2000, over 22,000 migrants have lost their lives trying to reach Europe. Refugees often risk their lives crossing the border in trucks and vans, which are overcrowded and poorly ventilated. In response to last week's deaths, Germany, Hungary, and Austria have increased their border controls beginning this morning. Protests were held in all three countries by supporters of the refugees, who say that the answer is not tighter controls, but an end to the wars and conflict that drive people from their homes.
An estimated 120,000 protesters gathered in Tokyo yesterday to protest legislation allowing Japanese soldiers to fight overseas. The proposed law change would allow Japanese soldiers to fight overseas for the first time since World War II. If the parliament's lower house passes the bill, the prime minister could deploy troops under, quote, collective self-defense, unquote, a term with no clear definition. Protesters of all ages joined the rally against Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, whose security policies are opposed by a majority of the public, polls show. In July, the prime minister pushed through a bill that would allow Japanese troops to be deployed to defend allies under attack. Since then, protests have taken place all summer in order to preserve Japan's pacifist constitution. The Tokyo rally was held along with more than 300 other protests in the country.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032 during business hours. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Eric Tegadoff, Paul Rowland, Emily Young, and Don Zur. Our engineer is Mike Fataklas. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris discuss the implosion of American politics. On alternative radio, Marxist economist Richard Wolff speaks on capitalism, fantasies, and realities. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host producer Dime Roberts talks with Olga Sanchez, artistic director of Milagro Theater, about La Luna Nueva, a multidisciplinary festival that kicks off Milagro's 35th season. She'll be joined by Susan Addy of the Obo Addy Legacy Project and Oranui Tahitian Dance. And at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews abstract painter Michelle Ross about her show, Trust Falls and Transparent Things, at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For 6 years, the Unist'ot'en clan has maintained a camp to guard their territory in what the Canadian state claims is northern British Columbia. The site of the camp is in a valley where several proposed gas and oil pipelines would pass. The Unist'ot'en are part of the Wet'suwet'en people, who occupy a large swath of unceded territory, whose Aboriginal title has been upheld by Canadian courts. Starting last year, the Unistoten have escorted several work crews from pipeline companies off the land, and they've maintained a checkpoint at the one bridge entering the area. In the past few weeks, the situation has gotten increasingly tense, with a massive increase of Canadian police and fears of an imminent raid on the camp. Earlier today, KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke with Zoe Blunt, with the Forest Action Network in Victoria, British Columbia, and an organizer of support caravans to the Unistoten camp.
So I'm speaking with Zoe Blunt, who, maybe you could just identify yourself.
I'm a director with Forest Action Network and a coordinator for the caravan at Unistoten camp.
And talk about, probably many of our listeners don't know what the Unistoten camp is.
There's an Indigenous reoccupation of the traditional land in northern BC. This has been going on for about 6 years now. And what they've done is they've moved into their old trap line, and they've been working that area, gathering medicines and food, trapping, hunting, fishing, and building a community. And so they've built a log cabin and then expanded it, doubled the size, built a bunkhouse. We've been sending just busloads of volunteers to the camp for the last 4 years, and these are non-Native allies who are putting themselves on the line, and this whole community is in the path of all the pipelines from the fracking fields in northwest BC, northeast BC, and the tar sands pipelines from Alberta. This camp lies in this one valley that all these pipelines have to go through if they want to reach Kitimat, which is the port. So the plan is to build a giant oil and gas export facility at the port of Kitimat on BC's north coast, and then from there ship tanker loads of oil and gas to China. And so this encampment, Unistoten camp, where Indigenous people are reoccupying their land, that is in the way, and they are not allowing oil and gas surveyors or anybody who works for the industry to come in, and they're not allowing any work to go forward. So things have really come to a head in the last few weeks here.
You mentioned that they're not letting anybody go through. So I understand, you know, over the past year, or I don't know exactly when it started, but there's been a number of helicopter crews, surveying crews, people coming in by truck who were refused passage or escorted off their territory by members of the camp. Yeah. How many episodes like that have occurred?
Oh, this has happened 5 or 6 times now, and they've been formally warned against trespassing on Indigenous land. And in Canada, this land is not under treaty, so the Indigenous